Good afternoon. Welcome. Can you all hear me okay?
Yes.
Great. Welcome to MoMA. My name is Veronica Roberts. I work in the Department of Painting and Sculpture, and I worked on the installation Focus All a Whip that's the subject of my talk today. It's upstairs on view in the fourth floor. So if you haven't seen it, it's a single wall drawing that fills the whole gallery. It's that big gallery, first one you see to the right when you are on the fourth floor overlooking the sculpture garden. And I first met Saul when I coordinated the Saul LeWitt retrospective at the Whitney, which was organized by SF MoMA in 2000. So I'm going to be speaking a bit from some personal experience having worked closely with him. And before I begin, I wanted to mention three places where you can see his work right now. If you're wondering why you're at MoMA looking at a slide of Dia Beacon, that's because in addition to the wall drawing that we have on view through June 1st, not much longer, there is an installation, a really beautiful installation that was extended until September of 2009 at Dia Beacon. And if you've never gone to Dia Beacon, I really encourage you to. The installation of LeWitt's are beautiful, but it's also just a pretty amazing space, I see nodding heads, so some of you have already been, a former Nabisco factory turned into minimal conceptual art museum of 1960s and 70s predominantly. And Saul actually handpicked the wall drawings that he installed, that were installed in this this mini retrospective of his there shortly before he passed away in 2007. So this was kind of one of his last hurrahs and focuses on the early work. And then a little further afield, requiring at least a full day trip, in North Adams, Massachusetts, at a sort of former paper mill town, in the Berkshires, is the most spectacular installation you could ever imagine. It's essentially a Saul LeWitt museum. Mass MoCA has a huge complex, but of buildings from this former factory, and one building that was unused, they recently converted as of this fall, last fall. They turned into an entire museum, essentially, of Saul's work. So it's three floors, as you see here from the model, and one floor entirely of his pencil wall drawings. I mean, one floor of his ink wash wall drawings, one floor of his acrylic. And so you can really kind of get an entire, the best retrospective you could imagine, over 100 wall drawings that they spent months, because the building was closed, it wasn't used prior to this, so they could spend months getting everything just right. And Saul knew about this before he passed away. He wasn't obviously able to see it once it opened, but it's really was a Herculean effort and is pretty spectacular. And unlike any other show, what I love is if you go to the Mass MoCA website, it just says on view for the next 25 years. So they worked that hard. They want to keep it up for a while. So don't wait 25 years, though. Go soon. You'll want to make repeated pilgrimages there. So I wanted to mention that, too. Okay, but this is the work that I'm going to be talking about as sort of a point of departure today, wall drawing number 260 that's in our collection and, as I said, on view upstairs. And what I'm going to do, this lecture is sort of in three parts. And the first part is going to be an introduction to this work and to Saul's wall drawings more broadly. The second is going to be a close look at the friendship between Saul LeWitt and Eva Hesse. I don't know if you're familiar with her work, but they were dear friends and influenced each other in many ways. And at some point, I'll spend more time researching that angle because I'm really fascinated by the ways that their work inspired one another. And I think this wall drawing has to do with that story, as I'll explain. And then the third is the conclusion, the brief conclusion, is based on a quote that he made in an interview called "Every Wall is a Door," a funny statement perhaps. And I just think that it epitomizes his work in many ways. So I'm thinking about his legacy. I'm going to draw from that quote. And I should mention that I'm happy to take questions as we're going. So just raise your hand or speak up. We're a small enough group, so feel free to ask me questions as we move along. So although Saul LeWitt is best known for his wall drawings, he was not the first artist to draw directly onto the wall. As he once humorously put it, "I think the cavemen came first." So that was not his radical accomplishment. But in his productive 40-year career, he produced more than 1,200 wall drawings. So really, this is such a big part of his legacy and what he's left to us. And they're really, I think, as I hope to demonstrate, not just ubiquitous, but quite remarkable. And he first began making the wall drawings in 1968. Let me show you this one. Sorry, it's a horrible reproduction, but it's very hard to reproduce. One of the reasons I didn't appreciate his work as much as I do now was not just from working with him, but a lot of the really beautiful pencil wall drawings don't reproduce because they just disappear. They turn into gossamer. And so all catalogs typically will reproduce a print instead of his wall drawing, or they'll reproduce a detail. So you can actually not really understand. I mean, all reproductions are inadequate, but particularly for a huge body of his work. So that's why you have to go to Mass MoCA and upstairs into our galleries. But the first wall drawing he made in the early years, he was working entirely with a number 2 graphite pencil directly onto the wall. He always worked with inexpensive materials, as so many artists do today. And it really, as you can see, are just lines directly onto a wall in different directions. And you'll have to take my word for it that they're lines in 4 directions, the 4 sort of basic directions, which are, you know, diagonal, the 2 diagonals, 1 horizontal and 1 vertical, and then he superimposed them in different combinations. And this is a better example of a later work he did in ink wash, so you can see that. And this became his trademark, these lines in 4 directions. We actually called them his coat of arms. And you can see here a work that was recently deinstalled from the lobby of SF MoMA that he did in acrylic. I mean, he returned to the lines in 4 directions were really, you know, what Mont Saint Victoire was to Cézanne and what humble vessels were to Morandi. This was his something he returned to throughout his entire career. And since he spent many of his years living in Italy, I like to think of it, you know, as his coat of arms. And he signed whenever he would write me a postcard or gave me a book for my birthday. He would always sign it with, as he did everyone else's, with his coat of arms. And it's such a basic gesture to draw a line in 4 different directions. There's very little that's expressive about that. And I think that was sort of the point for him, that he wanted to, in the early 1960s and late 60s, when he begins making these wall drawings, he really wanted to reduce art to square one, as he put it. And he, at the time, was working at the Museum of Modern Art, actually, as a night receptionist. And it was an interesting moment in MoMA's history. What I would have given to be alive then and working as a security guard at MoMA would have been great, because Dan Flavin was a security guard, and they became close friends, and Robert Mengold, a number of people. Lucy Lepard, who became an important art critic of this period, she was working in the library. So it was an exciting moment to be behind the scenes at MoMA. And he was good friends with all of them, and they would take their lunchtime breaks and talk about art. And we're really talking about how they wanted this generation that became known largely as minimal artists to sort of bring art back to square one and strip it of the sort of emotional, gestural qualities that, say, someone like Jackson Pollock had mastered. Saul really loved Jackson Pollock's work, but, you know, you couldn't really one-up Pollock. It kind of had been done to the best way imaginable. So really looking in a new direction. And I think Saul always liked the simplicity of working with basic elements, too, and finding making them interesting by what you do to them, but not using uninteresting elements in and of themselves. And you can see that even though our wall drawing includes more than just lines in 4 directions, it includes lines in 4 directions, but as you see from the title, it also includes arcs, straight, not straight, and broken lines. So from that repertoire of 4 lines grew an entire, 1,200 wall drawings. It was just, I think of them as musical notes, really, that you can create endless compositions with. And I wanted to point out in this next image, he talks about his goals for this, his sort of new way of approaching art, which he describes as conceptual art. He talks about his goals in this great essay, now famous text that he wrote for Art Forum in 1967, called Paragraphs on Conceptual Art. And in it, it's done a year before he's created his first wall drawing, but in it is where this fabulous quote comes from, where he says, the idea becomes a machine that makes the art. I think he had no idea that quote would end up on the T-shirts of people working at Mass MoCA. But the concept is paramount. That's what really we can, this is why conceptual art is the basis of conceptual art, is that the concept, the idea behind the work of art is more important than the gesture, than the line, than what is drawn onto the wall. It's really, and it begins and it is born out of an idea. It is born out of a concept. So when you think about how art is made, this is a radically different way of approaching it. You're not coming to art making with a preconceived image in your mind and then rendering it. You're not drawing studies, you know, with an image in mind. You're coming up with a concept. And what is the concept? Well, if we go back to this, the concept is quite simple. It's on black walls, all two-part combinations of arcs, straight, not straight, and broken lines from corners and sides. It may not sound simple. It has a funny way of sounding quite ornate, but really, you're talking about basic elements in combination. If you recall your, I don't know if it was fourth grade or sixth grade math, but you remember your permutations. These are permutations of elements being combined. And the reason he was drawn to this is in part that you have a preset plan. You create this idea that the work is drawn from. You have a preset plan. So it's a way of making decisions ahead of time and avoiding subjectivity to some degree. It's not about, you know, being carried away in the moment of art making. But it was interesting, what I find interesting about this sort of preset conceptual approach to art making is the way that even though it's logical and it involves a preset plan, you know, there are 180 squares in this work. There are always 180 squares in this work. That's how many combinations there are when you figure this out. But there's a certain element of, it combines both the logical and the intuitive and you know, in a way, even though he has this preset concept and a plan, you know, he himself doesn't know what the work is going to look like until it's created on the walls. You know, he can make a drawing and he can sort it out, but the idea in his head, you know, it doesn't have an immediate visual form. And I think he always loved that he would come up with these ideas that were first and foremost ideas, and then it was amazing to see what it actually looked like when it was rendered and when it was drawn. So there's a way in which it's very logical and figured out ahead of time, but there's always some element of surprise. And for me, and as a viewer, there's always that element of surprise too. Like, I've seen this work installed in other spaces, and it looks different every time. Yeah, you had a question.
I'm just curious, did he actually draw freehand, or did he use rulers and protractors?
Oh, good question. Yeah, so no, they're not being drawn freehand at all. In fact, Saul's kind of like the WPA of the second half of the 20th century, and he employed this, and I'll get to, you know, his use of assistants, but he employed so many artists. At the Mass MoCA opening, there were like 200 people who have been working with him over the past dozens of years, you know, art students and artists, and they have their whole, it's like a Renaissance workshop. They have all of the tools of the trade. To make the arcs, they had specially cut out foam core that had handles on it so they could hold it, and it was covered in blue tape so it wouldn't scratch the wall. And it was made just to MoMA's particular squares. And they had a perfect, you know, triangle shape for the diagonal lines and the straight lines that were just perfectly made for our space. And so no, it's not, nothing's done freehand except for one element, which I'll get to later in the talk. But there are definite tools of the trade, and there's going to be a catalog resume coming out that will detail sort of the process of making them, because they, it's pretty interesting. Yeah, you have a question.
Yeah, did he work at a smaller scale and then have this, you know, expand through the configuration of the wall?
Good question, and definite no is the answer, because that is one of the things that's been, you know, since he's passed away, that's been one of the challenges. How do we, you know, continue to recreate these works that are so site-specific? And, you know, how did we decide, for example, this is in our collection and we've installed it before, but how did we know that it was okay to install it in a particular space? And that's been something we've been grappling with. People who work on his work have been grappling with, how do we know what we can do? What size does this need to be? And there's no like hard and fast rules. There has to be some flexibility since no two spaces are alike. But Saul never would have wanted us to do this on a small scale. You know, if the squares were this big, it wouldn't have the same impact. Similarly, he hated art that was too big and felt that it should be at a human scale. And in fact, all of the elements, when he originally, all of the elements in his wall drawings, he always felt should be able to be drawn by the human hand. So the arcs are always sort of what the human hand would be capable of doing. He would never make this, you know, a la Rosenquist on a billboard scale where you would need, you know, this was supposed to be something that could be drawn by hand and by, and this, and, And really, the measurements indicate something about the human body. So we don't have an exact set of stipulations of how we can redo and recreate works, but we do know, for example, this work has to be in a horizontal format. That work has to be vertical. In his lifetime, it was done 6 times, always within this certain range of size and scale. So if I think you can sort of, if you do your homework and figure out what is possible and what is okay. But in, you know, there were a lot of interviews with him asking questions like the ones you're asking. Yeah.
I saw the show at the Whitney, and they had a little documentary show there with the assistants doing the drawings.
It's at Mass MoCA as well, actually, that documentary.
And now those, where he's drawing, or the assistants, rather, are drawing in pencil, eventually when the show is over, the museum whitewashes that and they hang up.
Yeah, I have a little fragment upstairs at my desk that I had them save for me. But yes, they are just painted over.
So now, why are some kept? Why did he?
None are kept. They're all painted.
But these are. You said this was reinstalled in other places.
In other words, I mean, they're permanent until destroyed, is how he liked to put it. They're permanent until destroyed. So, you know, if MoMA commissions a wall drawing, we could keep it up forever. I mean, we have one right outside the modern restaurant that's been up for years. It's going to stay up indefinitely.
But like this is.
But this is for, we're going to need to use this space again, so it'll be painted over in a couple of weeks. It'll be painted right over, yep.
Oh.
Be painted right over, and that's always the case, yeah.
Were there situations where he just sent instructions or a little card saying, this is what needs to be done, and he wasn't even present? So that would be documentation that you can later use.
Absolutely, and I'll get to that. I should move ahead because I think I may be able to answer some of these questions because they do ask a lot of questions of us, I think, in terms of how they're made. And I wanted to talk a little bit about, just briefly, about some of his influences and where he's coming from. One key influence is the work of Jasper Johns. And when he was working here at MoMA in the 60s, there was a big Jasper Johns show, and Jasper Johns was one of the, you know, sort of big artists of the day. One of the things that we know from Jasper Johns' work is that he was respecting the integrity of the picture plane, that he, in the paintings that he was making in the 50s and early 60s, he was painting things that were themselves flat. He was really calling attention to the fact that the canvas is a flat surface, and painting things that were themselves flat. And then when he had three-dimensional elements, of course, that he made them out of wood, and they were sculptural. But so he would paint things like targets and flags and this seemed like a very radical act in the 50s and 60s. And Saul felt that it made more sense. He loved this work, and he felt it made more sense to work directly onto the wall, like taking it one step further. Yes, if the wall and if the canvas is flat, why not work directly onto the wall and eliminate the object entirely? So that was one thing, one person who was important to him. And as he once put it in a quote I really love, he said, "A drawing of a person is not a person. A drawing of a line is a line." I mean, you can't get more honest than that, right? That there was a certain, to his aesthetic, you know, that a line is a line. There's a certain honesty to it, whereas a drawing of a person is automatically an illusion, an invention. And another interesting influence, sorry, I'm using my mouse improperly. Another really important influence is the work of Edward Muybridge, the 19th century British photographer. And when Saul moved to New York, the previous tenant in his apartment on the Lower East Side had left behind a book of Muybridge photographs. And they became really influential. Let me give you a little background if you're not familiar with the great stories about Muybridge's contributions to photography. But in 1872, Leland Stanford hired Muybridge to settle an age-old debate that was about whether all 4 feet of a horse lift up off the ground when a horse is galloping. And Stanford suspected that they did, but he wanted proof, and photography had not been perfected in such a way that you could document this yet. So he thought he had the money to hire Muybridge. I mean, at the time, he had just completed the Transcontinental Railroad. He was the former governor of California, a railroad baron. I mean, he was a mega, mega millionaire. And he was absolutely obsessed with horses. So what Muybridge did is he set up 12 cameras about 2 feet apart on a track at Stanford's horse farm. What became the campus of Stanford University was really just his horse farm. And that's where Muybridge set up these cameras. And what he did is he came up with a shutter speed that was fast enough that when the horse galloped, it would hit a piece of string or a little trigger that would snap each camera. And he was able to document and capture something that the eye couldn't see. And you can see he settled the debate. You look at the still number two and number three, you can see that when a horse is galloping, all 4 feet do in fact leave the ground. And this was obviously an important discovery. It led to motion pictures, led to so many things. And he became an instant celebrity and was talking about these, kind of like Al Gore and An Inconvenient Truth. He was in demand on the lecture circuit around the country and showing his horses. But this ended up being something that Saul really found exciting and was pivotal to his own conceptual approach to art making, because what he liked about it was this idea of what he called seriality, not cereal like breakfast cereal, but cereal like series. And he liked this idea of serialism, of seriality, where you would have a system in place and there would be repeated elements, but in regulated changes. So if you think of these horses, there's a logic to the series of photographs. Every two feet, the camera was snapping. And if you think about Saul's work, I mean, look at this. This is the same drawing as our drawing upstairs, but at SF MoMA. Think of the horse's legs and the horse just being replaced by lines and by arcs. And they have very regulated, easy to determine changes that they make. And instead of, so you sort of see them dancing across the wall, but in a way that has a logic to it, in the same way that Muybridge's photos did. So Muybridge became, I think, really influential. I wanted to say something also about the fact that Saul uses assistants, because I know that had come up earlier. This is the first installation that he did, as I mentioned, of our wall drawing, and it was at SF MoMA, and at the time it was on one single wall in their old building, a long, long wall, horizontal wall, And he worked with assistants then. There's a bit of a myth that Saul never did any wall drawings himself. That first one at Paula Cooper, he drew himself. He drew them for years, actually. But as you can imagine, as he became a bit more successful and his work was in demand, he couldn't be in Tokyo drawing a wall drawing and in Paris drawing a different wall drawing and in LA drawing a different wall drawing. That would lead to an unhappy marriage and life and a lot of frequent flyer miles. So he ended up... he ended up working with assistants pretty early on, after a couple of years, once he was doing well. And you can also see that as his walls, some of them got bigger, he really could use the help. I mean, museums need things to get done quickly, so, he needed the help. But remember that, I mean, he really likened his role as being similar to that of a composer, and that's always the way I felt is most useful to think about it. I mean, if you're the composer, you create the piece of music, and just because Brahms isn't alive with us today, that doesn't make it not a Brahms piece of music. But a different group, a different orchestra, a different symphony is going to perform that music throughout time and in perpetuity, and it's never going to be the same. It's never going to be exactly the same at any performance. It can be performed by better musicians, by worse musicians. It's always going to be different. But it is still Brahms. It is still Brahms's composition. And so Saul really saw himself that way, as coming up with the score. And the beauty of it is, of course, that it is different every time it's performed, every time it's installed. It was different at SF MoMA than it is upstairs right now in our galleries. And Saul also worked briefly with the architect I.M. Pei very early on in his career. And was always interested in architecture. And similarly, it's like an architect. You don't have to build the building that you design in order to be credited as the person with the idea. So he did work with assistants, and so as he passed away, obviously it's the assistants who are doing it now. And the title really serves as the instruction to the assistant. So what does the assistant get? How do we actually create this work in our space? Well, we have a diagram showing the order of the different elements as they're superimposed, and we hired someone who'd worked with him for years and years to figure out how it could fit in our space. Because, of course, you don't want to have, a half of a square and then some black space above that. I mean, walls are set height, so you had to kind of make it work in our space. And to be honest, the walls aren't a perfect dimension too. You can't just divide and make a perfect square. So even though this is a gridded work, we ended up having to fudge a little bit. You know, the sides might be a little wider than top to bottom, for example. So there's a bit of an art to just getting this onto the space. But as long as we're following the logic, as long as we're using the materials that he wanted us to use, as long as every element fulfills these set of instructions, we're in good shape. And here is the key that you see actually on view upstairs, showing here you see the 20 different elements, the not straight lines, the arcs, the broken lines, etc., going from sides and corners. And then here you see it mapped out. So they're given numbers. And Saul did this for SF MoMA, so we have those early instructions too. And you can see this one says 1, 2. So this is element 1, this is element 2. So the very first square in our installation is this superimposed over that. And then the next one might be 1 and 3, and then it's 1 and 4, and then it's 1 and 5, and you keep going, if you recall your permutations from fourth grade. And so you just keep going until so it starts out mostly as arcs, and then it sort of ends up mostly as broken lines at the end. So the very last corner square is going to be a diagonal broken line, and then this other diagonal broken line. And the key is right in the gallery, is to sort of help people make sense of the work. And when Saul began to introduce color a year after, in 1969, it's interesting that he worked with a very preset and not arbitrary, not capricious use of color. He actually only worked with red, yellow, blue, and graphite, or black. You could think of it as gray or black. And so that's a horrible reproduction, but it's a beautiful wall drawing made out of colored pencil. And what you see is that for years, he's only working with the primary colors and with gray, and he's creating a real range of color, because of course once you superimpose a diagonal yellow line over a diagonal blue line, you're going to get green from a distance. So there are these really beautiful colorful works, but he's never using color in a very arbitrary way. He's using it in a very systematic way. And I love that it's of course 4 colors and 4 lines, so he could easily assign each direction a color. There's just a certain beauty and harmony to that. And again, think about the way color's been used historically by artists. You can think about Rothko reds or Picasso blues. I mean, color is so intertwined with psychology for us. That's why we care when we paint our rooms, getting it the right color so we're not horribly depressed. And you think about the expressions, even the way our language, like I'm feeling blue or I'm green with envy. I mean, colors are so loaded. And Saul really, there's just a purity to the way he's using them that's really restrained and quite different from that. I mentioned that he works with assistants. This is one of my favorite wall drawings that we recreated at the Whitney, and it's at Dia Beacon. And it's one he called Star Wars, because he'd made it shortly after Star Wars came out, and it kind of looks like an intergalactic battle. And one of the curatorial assistants who was working on the project was an artist, and he asked if he could get a day off to draw it, and so he did. And what it is that Saul created a drawing, it's, as you see from the title, it's a grid covering a black wall, white lines to points on the grid, 16 lines from the center. He has all these different lines, but basically the points are determined by the draftsman. Like, you come up with it. So this work literally never looks the same twice unless someone really wants to follow their previous guidelines. So what it means is that we painted the wall black, covered a grid onto it. You can't really see the grid, but if you go upstairs, you can see the pencil grid is never concealed. So there's a pencil grid, take my word for it, there's a pencil grid on this. And then using the instructions, my friend and coworker just randomly picked some points, making sure it was a certain number of points dictated by the wall drawing. He just randomly picked them without thinking about it. That was kind of, the point was random. And then a different group of people that he was part of would start connecting with chalk or with crayon, the corners to those points, the sides to those points. So you get a different sort of burst of lines each time. And Saul would do that. There are a number of wonderful works at Beacon where it's, as far as the draftsman can draw, there's sort of things where they're really letting the draftsman kind of have a role in the work. It's really more of a collaboration. And I want to skip ahead, but I just wanted to briefly mention that I focus mainly on the pencil wall drawings, but in the 1980s, he moves to Spoleto, Italy, and also gets married. And his work really opens up. So he still is working with systems. He's still working with concepts as the primary thing, but he starts working with ink washes and really clearly referencing Italian Renaissance traditions. And he's looking at all these amazing Pieros, who he was obsessed with, Piero della Francesca, and he's looking at all of these frescoes. And so the surface really has this appearance and this nod to history. And he's thinking about, he once said to me that he was thinking about art less as an avant-garde kind of game and more in more universal ways, and sort of thinking about it. He who's quoted as saying he'd like to make something he wouldn't be ashamed of showing Giotto. But he's still working with only red, yellow, blue, and gray ink. And so the colors that you're seeing, for example, on the left here, are all the draftsmen use rags, and they are putting those colors in different preset layers to create these really just like jewel-like tones. And what's interesting is the lines, the arcs that you see from the early work are really, and basic geometric shapes are yielding to things like stars, forms derived from cubes, pyramids, trapezoids. So there's an opening of the work. And sometimes the system, you know, in the wall drawing upstairs, there's 180 squares. There's always 180 squares. That's the set number. It never can change of those unique combinations of elements. Well, in these works, it's forms derived from a cube. There's an infinite potential. There's no the system goes from being finite to infinite. So there's, I think that's a new way of still you know, follows Saul's logic, but it really opens up. Here's the wonderful one at the National Gallery that's an example of these ink washes that I'm telling you about. And I just wanted to show you the National Gallery certificate and diagram, getting back to your question earlier about what we have and what we receive. So for every wall drawing, there is a diagram and a certificate. And we have these upstairs in our files. And the diagram shows, if in this case, what you're seeing is it shows the color combinations. So I'll show you a detail, but it might say RGGB. And that means, RRYB. So it would be red, red, yellow, black, or you might use gray. And that's the order of a color put on here. And then it says here, it spells it out. The instructions are a wall divided vertically into four equal squares, each bordered by black bands. You know, the title really spells out how the work should be made. And then it's signed by him. And here you see a detail of those two panels. And why a certificate? Why this whole process? Well, first of all, these things only, you know, if you're to own a Saul LeWitt, this and you were to move, you know, you can paint over your wall and have it remade in the next space. It's not like, he's doing away with the whole idea of the art object itself. You know, it's sort of it can appear and disappear. And so this is really kind of your record of what you have and what is made. And this is just a later work when he starts working with acrylics, and there's a whole floor dedicated to his acrylic wall drawings at Massimoca. And you can see that he's starting to really move away from a system. These, I think, go a whole different direction.
Would this be on a grid, too?
That was on a grid, but you wouldn't see it. That's done in a totally different way. I didn't have time to get into it, but those are quite different. And it's called loopy doopy. Like, what kind of instructions are those? Loopy doopy? I mean, not very clear. So I wanted to talk about Eva Hesse. And when they met in 1960, they were both unknown artists. He wasn't more famous than she, or vice versa. They were both pretty much, you know, unknown artists. Neither of them had any shows. They met through some mutual friends, and they became and they both lived downtown in New York and became really close friends. And I think in many ways Saul was, I mean, he was about 10 years older than her, so he was a bit of a mentor, although, as I'd like to point out in this talk, her work really influences his as much as the other way around. And over the course of the few years that they knew each other for about a decade, they were part of a tight-knit circle, including Bob and Sylvia Mangold. Again, Mangold was working as a guard. The artist Robert Ryman and Lucy Lepard, who were married to each other. I mean, this was all part of their circle. And here you see her in her studio. And in many ways, when you look at their work, you think, gosh, it couldn't be more different. I mean, there are no instructions to go with this drawing. And her work is so, the organic contours of it, the aspect of the hand, and always referencing the human body, and always you know, they're it's just, it seems worlds apart. And I think they became, one of the things I've always loved about Saul, since I'm an avid letter writer, I love that he was such a passionate correspondent. He was the best letter writer. He wrote me letters in grad school asking how my studies were going. And he's constantly, like anyone who knows him, has some great postcard from him and constantly writing. I mean, that old fashioned tradition of good letter writing and not emails. And he and Eva Hesse, I think, became so close in part because she moved to Germany for a year. After they'd become friends, she and her husband moved to Germany, and they just wrote letters constantly. I mean, we have her diaries, and so we have this like voluminous correspondence between the two of them. And she was someone who, at this moment in her career in 1965, when she's in Germany, I want to show you a work like this is one of the works that she's working on. She was really questioning herself and questioning whether she was making art that was any good. And she would write to Saul these long letters that just filled with doubt. And actually, it was as she was working on this piece, which is in MoMA's collection, that she writes a letter to Saul about being at an impasse. And I love this response so much that I hope you don't mind if I read it to you. So this is what Saul says back as she's worrying about this piece in progress. "You seem the same as always, and being you, hate every minute of it. Don't. Learn to say fuck you to the world once in a while. You have every right to. Just stop thinking, worrying, looking over your shoulder, wondering, doubting, fearing, hurting, hoping for some easy way out, struggling, gasping, it continues, confusing, itching, scratching, and mumbling. Stop it and just do. From your description and from what I know of your previous work and your ability, the work you are doing sounds very good." And he quotes what she describes. "Drawings, clean, clear, but crazy like machines, larger, bolder, nonsense. That sounds wonderful, real nonsense. Do more. More nonsense, more crazy, more machines, more breasts, more penises." I think you could see breasts being referenced pretty easily here. "Whatever, make them abound with nonsense. Try and tickle something inside of you, your weird humor. Don't worry about cool, make your own cool. Make your own world. If you fear, make it work for you. Draw and paint your fear of anxiety. And stop worrying about big, deep things. You must practice being stupid, dumb, unthinking. I have much confidence in you, and even though you are tormenting yourself, the work you do is very good. Try to make some bad work, the worst you can think of, and see what happens. But mainly relax and let everything go to hell." So I love this letter, and I think it's just as you can imagine, whether you're an artist or someone else, when you're at that impasse and trying desperately and questioning yourself and questioning your worth and questioning whether what you're doing has anything to add to the world. I mean, what a great letter to receive. So you can see how Saul was very important, obviously, in these sorts of really encouraging ways. He was also an ardent feminist, and he noticed that women artists were not given the same kind of recognition. I mean, Eva Hesse was an extraordinary artist and really only had one show in her entire lifetime, which I just find mind-boggling. And it was a generation when women were just overlooked, and he was constantly talking about how important her work was, telling people. He lived in a studio later on that Adrian Piper, a much younger artist, lived down, I can't remember if it was upstairs or downstairs, and when curators would come to his studio, he'd always send them over to her studio, and just really talked about how he's, you know, the disparities that he saw in the art world, and was, I think, a really kind of passionate and articulate voice when there weren't enough of them. And you can see in her work that in 1967, when she's back from Germany, you can really see the influence of minimal artists, influence of people like Saul, the use of the grid, still, though, in a completely distinctive Hesse way. You know, these circles are hand-drawn. There's something kind of interesting about the repetition, the tightness of them all. This is not something Saul would have done. But you can see the spirit of minimalism having certainly changed her work from some of the earlier examples that I showed you. I love this drawing also. Very, you know, again, the basic geometric shapes of minimalism, but done in such a way where her own hand is clearly present. Once again, you know, a repetition of forms, but with materials that are so different than the hard materials used by the minimalists and the cheap materials. These are materials that are really worked with by hand and capture light and have much more of the world in them. And so how did Eva influence Saul? Well, she died very young, unfortunately, in her early 30s in April of 1970. And when he heard about this, he was in the middle of an installation in Paris at the Yvon Lambert Gallery. And he immediately changed one of his wall drawings, and he said it was an homage to her. And it was this wall drawing, number 46, and it's called Vertical Lines, Not Straight, Not Touching, Uniformly Dispersed with Maximum Density, Covering the Entire Surface of the Wall. And he never used a not straight line. It wasn't very Saul-like to use a not straight line. He was all about the straight line. But he decided to create this, also done, as you can imagine, done by hand. Still has a system. There's still some logic to it. He gives instructions. But it was, he said it was a way of sort of paying homage to her and her work, the irregular contours of her line. What I love is that it's bringing her work, together with his. And not only, it wasn't an isolated example. I mean, he began using the not straight line and continued using it throughout the rest of his career. So it became part of his own repertoire, but it was something, it wasn't an isolated case. It became, developed and continued to use it throughout his life. And this is a wall drawing that opens the Dia Beacon show, and I think it's telling that he always included it in every retrospective. When he got to pick what works he was doing, this is always, last show of his life, he puts it as the first work you see when you walk into Dia Beacon. Interestingly, when it was installed at the Whitney next to a window and it was always raining, I mean, I just found this to be a very emotional work, actually, not straight lines. It doesn't sound emotional, but it became very emotional. You could extrapolate and start seeing it as tears. You could see it as so many things. It's just a really beautiful, beautiful drawing. I thought it was interesting that the person who was running the whole Whitney crew of draftsmen, a man named Joe Watanabe, he was very, very close to, and who made many of his drawings, Joe always drew this. It was like the only drawing he did. This is the one he did. And when I went to MassMoCA and saw it on view, I ran into him and Joe Watanabe in the lobby, and I was like, Joe, did you do wall drawing 46? And he's like, yeah, I did that one. So he had come all the way up to the Berkshires just to draw this drawing, because it was something that had personal significance to Saul and to the sort of family of artists that he worked with. And you can see the not straight lines that are in our wall drawing upstairs are a bit of that. So here I've zoomed in on two squares where you see, Saul's distinctive element combined with the not straight line, and sort of a marriage of those two forms. And of course, the not straight line is the one part. You asked about what tools are used in these wall drawings. Well, that's the one part there are no tools for. It's a not straight line. So you see the hand of the draftsman is always going to be present, and it's always going to look different. And it's the one element of his work where there is a certain degree of variability. And I also wanted to say, in terms of Ava's work influencing his, that when she was alive, he was would help her install some of her works. And I think the other influence comes from those experiences. He knew this work so well. So this is an example of a piece that she did called Metronomic Irregularity. The word irregularity says something just about her work. Everything about Saul's work is typically all about regularity, right? And this work she made in 1966, it no longer exists, and there aren't good reproductions, but this is sort of a, this is a related work, so this is not the exact work, but she made three, and this is the first one, and Saul helped with the second. So in the one solo show she had, in her lifetime, she installed this work, and you can see it's these gray panels, these wood panels painted gray, with a grid on them, a little bit of Saul there, or minimalism there, and then there are these ropes, or these sort of thin wires, actually, but they're sort of bundled wires that are wrapped between and are sort of sewn into the panels and connect the left side to the right. So you have this beautiful play between order and uniformity of the grid with the chaotic wave and tangle of these beautiful lines. And Saul talked about installing this. He and the artist Mel Bochner helped her install this in this gallery. And this was 2 years before Saul made his first wall drawing. And he talked about how, in fact, I will read you, I think I have the quote, let me see. He talks about, no, I don't have it, sorry. But he talks about how he was so influenced by this work, and one of the things he loved about it was the idea that it's never the same twice. That every time you would install this, because the wires, they'd have to be taken out, and they're always done in the gallery, and it wasn't stored like this. The idea is Ava always intended for this to be woven anew each time, and that was something that Saul felt like was so interesting, and you can see how his own wall drawings never the same way twice, And similarly, he really talks about how he feels she was a kind of precursor to the whole installation art movement. The idea of installing things, you know, there's so much installation art in contemporary art scene, but this idea that a work could be different and changing, and it's not a fixed object that's immutably the same, that I think is really quite beautiful. And I've often thought, there's another work, that's the third one, I think this was one that Robert Smithson owned for a while. And I've often thought, you know, Saul made all of these gouaches throughout his life. He'd wake up every day. He was the most voracious worker. He didn't believe in vacations. He liked working every day. And he would wake up every morning and make a gouache by hand. So he had this whole practice that existed without his direct involvement. You know, these wall drawings take on a life of their own. They're executed by other artists. But every morning he still had that old-fashioned part of his practice where he made these gouaches, which are kind of like opaque watercolors. And I've always felt that they like look a lot like Eva Hesse. There's a bit of Hesse in them. So I want to conclude with this quote, "Every wall is a door," to talk just in the last few minutes about Saul's legacy. And I love this quote because every wall is a door. It's kind of funny. Every wall is a door. That seems ridiculous. It's like kind of an absurd statement. But every wall is a door. I think you can see it in many ways as speaking to his work. Every wall is a door in the sense that one work often led to the next. You know, he'd come up with one system of lines and circles and squares, and then that would give him an idea for the next one. You know, maybe I'll change this one element, or maybe I'll remove that or add that. So this was the way he worked was so generative. It created his own work. Each work created the next. So it was really a door to the next piece. Similarly, if you think about art and painting, it's always, since the Renaissance, it's been a window onto the world. That was Alberti, the architect and philosopher and artist. You know, he talked about painting as a window onto the world. And that's the historic notion of painting that we have. It, you know, you look at a Vermeer painting and you step into that world. You can imagine yourself there. And instead of offering a window onto the outside world, Saul really provided a door. And it was a door that led into the world of ideas. It wasn't a window, it was a door. And we enter it through our minds, but it's not about an illusion. You know, think back to that quote I mentioned of every line, every drawing of a person is not a real person, but every drawing of a line is a real line. So it's really a completely different notion of art making. Similarly, sometimes every wall is literally a door. So, sorry, I'm skipping ahead. This is a wall drawing he did in Italy, in Torino, and he showed up at the space. This is it at Mass MoCA, but he showed up at the space. This is what it looked like. You can't see the whole wall, but you can see the ceiling was just totally crazy. I mean, just a wacky space. And there were these ugly outlets, and they couldn't change that in time for his drawing. So he decided, you know, I'm just going to take advantage of this. I'm going to create a wall drawing. And he called it, we called it the snap drawing, but he used these snap architectural lines, and he connected every corner of every ugly object, like the socket, to every other corner of the wall and the ceiling. And you got this beautiful, crazy web. And so I think, so sometimes, as you can see in the Mass MoCA one, sometimes walls are quite literally doors. When we installed this at the Whitney, my job, and this was one of the more fun things for my daily routine, which was often boring, but I got to pick the wall. I had to like do some reconnaissance work and figure out which wall we were going to, you know, install this on. So, of course, there was this really ugly back gallery with an exit door, and it had, like, two exit doors, and it had, you know, an outlet. I mean, it was just, like, the place you don't want your art. And I presented it to Saul and said, I think this is the perfect spot, you know, and the door helped, and the exit sign helped, so sure enough, we got it, and that was where he installed this work. And again, it's different every single time, and here you see the outlets and them creating the work. But most of all, I wanted to say, and to conclude, that if Saul's walls are doors, they are open doors. Openness and generosity are two of the defining characteristics that I think summed up both Saul the artist and Saul the person. The openness and the generosity. There's been so much, you know, these days I think we really try to look away from biography. Biography has been denigrated because it's so often I think we've, you know, you can confuse the person with the work. And Saul's work in general was not very biographical. But I think there's... I think the one exception I would say to this is that the openness that he had as a person and the generosity he had as a person, I think you can feel in the artwork. The nature of the collaboration with the draftsman, for example. The fact that anytime he had an exhibition, the show at the Whitney, he would make a series of prints for every single person, including interns who had worked on the show, and I had to give them to the head of publications. I mean, I spent all day like distributing these 65 prints that he made, and that was very typical of his practice. He traded with younger artists. I remember Fred Talmaselli telling me that when he was starting out, he asked Saul if Saul would trade a work. You know, artists do this pretty frequently, but not everyone who is starting out in the art world is going to ask someone as famous as Saul if they will trade a work, and Saul never said no. He always said, yeah, what do you want? You know, this is what I have. I'd love that. And he has this amazing collection that's now given to the Wadsworth Athenaeum of all these young artists, many of whom became really famous artists in their own right, but they remember having traded with him. He was open and generous also in the sense that he managed to free himself of many conventions. He never worked with one dealer. He's represented by Pace now, but he worked with Paula Cooper, he worked with James Cohen, he worked with Barbara Krakow in Boston. You know, he said yes to everything. He wasn't about like having some exclusive relationship that only benefited one person. And he employed countless artists, as I've mentioned. And I think his work has been open and generous in laying a path for other artists. Many artists talk about just how influential his approach is, not so much the formal qualities of his work, but just the conceptual approach and having this preconceived idea and working from concepts can be liberating, can be freeing. So people like Jennifer Bartlett talk about how important that example was to his work, and Adrian Piper talks at length about that. So in conclusion, I just want to, yes, if Saul's walls are doors, then they are definitely open doors. So thanks so much, and feel free to ask me any questions. Yeah.
That letter you read out to April.
Yeah.
Is it reproduced anywhere?
That was the first question asked on Monday, and I ended up having to pass around a sheet and promising to send it to everyone. So I will do the same today because it's a great letter, and if anyone would like a copy, it is published in one of Ava Hesse's books, so I'm happy to email a scan once I have 2 minutes to scan it. I will email a scan to anyone who'd like it. But it's published in one of her books, and I tore off the last page for the last time, so I don't have a blank page, but here, I think I can pass this around, scrap of paper. If anyone else would like a copy, I'm happy to send it to you if you give me your email or mailing address. Any other questions? Yeah.
I just watched the movie the other night, Gets People in Art. Mama's Show, and Solowit was in it, and Jackson Pollock, and Robert Morris, all these guys.
Him the person or him the art? Because he hated being videoed.
I think they pulled together, you know.
Okay.
Curious, you know, just one snapshot. But he didn't speak on it or anything. But
there he is at left. He occasionally would show you himself in an installation photo, but that was about it.
They talked about the terms geometric abstractionist, which to me is what this is, versus abstract expressionist, Pollock, and others. Where do you think, it's a technical question, but if you were to say, what
he would write that,
you know, is he like a Mondrian? Like, I would put Mondrian.
He loved Mondrian. He loved Mondrian's work. But the difference is that he's not, his shapes are geometric, but there's a system behind them, a preset system. So many artists who work with geometric shapes and those that sort of pared down vocabulary aren't working from a concept ahead of time. So he didn't really like being labeled a minimalist. He always said that he thought that sounded like artists who make works for people in preschool, like mini art for mini people, he would talk about. But so he didn't really like labels. But I think, you know, in conceptual art, it's sort of a broader term. It's not like one specific movement. I mean, there are artists who consider themselves conceptual now. So I think that's the key difference. There are many artists who work with geometric shapes. I could make a painting right now of a square that doesn't make me a conceptual artist. That makes me a geometric abstractionist, perhaps. But
so what would you call?
Conceptual. I would call him conceptual. Yeah, I'm. Since that's what he called himself, I'm gonna let him call himself a conceptual artist. But that's a pretty open space to occupy. Yeah.
You said something so interesting about the size of the
arc. Yeah. The
and the relationship to the body.
Mm-hmm.
Or can you say? say, or was he at all interested beyond that in the relationship of our bodies into the space and the size of this series on the wall?
Yes, that's a great question. That's one of the things I'm most interested in right now. Also thinking about his relationship with Hesse, because Hesse is known as an artist who always was working with her body and like the connotations with the body. You know, I showed that Ring Around a Rosie work that looks like a breast, and you know, and you think of their work as so different, Saul having no relationship to the body, when of course his work has has so much to do with the body. And he talks about it only early on in his career. He talks about how it was really important that every shape somehow reference the arc, you know, that was possible from a human hand. And he never, and he talks about scale, and he lambasts artists who he thinks works on too large of a scale. He talks about how it should be human scale and how architecture is fundamentally a space for human beings, and so by working with walls, it's all about that space of humanity and that space of that scale of the human body. And then he felt that wall drawings inherently should have, you know, should correspond to a human scale. So I want to look into that more, but I think that's really, I think it is really important, and it's easy to not think about that when you're looking at a world of lines and circles and squares. But I think of the Vitruvian Man, too, that Leonardo did, the sort of circle. There's a wall drawing that looks a lot like it, just removed the Vitruvian Man himself from the middle. But there's always that, like, scale of the body there that so many other artists are more obviously connected to. So I need to look into that a little bit more. All right, well, thank you, guys. I'll answer any other questions just separately.
Thank you.
It's wonderful. It's a wonderful lecture.
Oh, good. Thanks for
so
coming.
Much.
Are you